is Alexis Guzman, who is a second-year medical student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Medicine, and who has a public health undergraduate degree from the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Good morning, everyone. So today I'll be talking about evaluating the effects of statewide smoking regulations on smoking behaviors among participants in the Survey of the Health of Wisconsin. So I have no relationships to disclose. So the Survey of the Health of Wisconsin, the background, what does show? It's an annual survey of a health status of Wisconsin residents. It is a household survey, not a telephone survey. The people that participate are adults 21 to 74 years old from various communities across the entire state, and information is collected about health, demographics, behavioral, lifestyle, and housing characteristics, and we also collected a detailed smoking history. So the smoking history questionnaire included questions about smoking behaviors, exposure to secondhand tobacco smoke, the length and extent of tobacco use, and quit attempts and methods used to stop smoking. Here's the law that was passed on July 5, 2010. It is called the Wisconsin Act 12, and it was a statewide law banning smoking in public places and places of employment. So our research questions were, did this law have an impact on changing the smoking behaviors of Wisconsin, and did it change secondhand smoke exposure and home smoking policies across the state? So we hypothesized that those surveyed after Wisconsin Act 12 should have a lower smoking prevalence, lower secondhand smoke exposure, increased no smoking policies in their households, and participants after the law, surveyed after the law was passed, should have a higher desire to quit smoking. So a smoking history was obtained from 1,341 show participants from 2008 to 2010. 273 of these participants were excluded from the analysis because they lived in communities that had a smoking ban prior to Wisconsin Act 12, and we felt that it was important to exclude these participants if we were going to analyze the effects of this particular law. So this left us with 1,068 participants who lived in communities that did not have a smoking ban prior to Wisconsin Act 12. 634 participants were surveyed before Wisconsin Act 12, and 434 were surveyed after. So here are our first set of results. This shows the smoking status comparing participants after versus before the ban. And as you can see here, before the ban, 52% of the people surveyed before the ban were never smokers, 30.1% were former smokers, and 17.9% were current smokers. And after the ban, 52% were never smokers, 28.8% were former smokers, and 19.2% were current smokers. And these differences weren't statistically significant. Here are results showing the exposure to secondhand smoke comparing participants after versus before the ban. And as we can see, participant exposure to smoke outside the home went down from 55.5% before the ban to 32.3% after the ban. Exposure to smoke at work went down from 12.2% to 9% after the ban. And exposure to smoke at home went down from 13% to 6.6% after the ban. These results show smoking behaviors and home smoking policies comparing participants once again after versus before the ban. Current smokers who wanted to completely quit went from 87.5% to 83.3% after the ban. Current smokers considering quitting went from 80.7% to 77.9%. And once again, these values weren't statistically significant. And participants who had strict home smoking policies that did not allow smoking in their households went up from 74% to 79.6%. These results show the odds ratios of secondhand smoke exposures and attitudes comparing participants once again after versus before the ban. Participants being exposed to smoke outside the home, you were more like 0.3 times as likely of being exposed to smoke outside the home after versus before the ban, 0.56 times as likely of being exposed to smoke at work, 0.39 times as likely of being exposed to smoke at home. You were 1.14 times as likely of considering quitting within the next 6 months after versus before the ban, and 1.34 times as likely of having a strict no smoking policy in your household after versus before the ban. These results are by age stratification, comparing secondhand smoke exposure and home smoking policies after versus before the ban. We have three age groups, 21 to 40-year-old age group, a 41 to 60-year-old age group, and a 61 to 74-year-old age group. Participant exposure to smoke outside the home, as you can see, it went down among all three age groups about equally. Participant exposure to smoke at work went down in all three age groups, but went down further in the older age group. Participant exposure to smoke at home went down again in all age groups, and it went down the furthest in the oldest age group again. And participants having a strict ban in the home went up in the 41 to 60-year-old age group and the 61 to 74-year-old age group. So these results are now by income stratification, comparing secondhand smoke exposure and home smoking policies after versus before the ban once again. For our three income groups, we had incomes of less than $30,000 per year, $30,000 to $60,000 per year, and greater than $60,000 per year. And participant exposure to smoke outside the home went down in all three income groups, but went down further in the highest income groups. And for participant exposure to smoke at work and at home, it went down in the higher income groups, stayed about the same in the lower income group. And exposure to smoke at home, it went down in the lowest income and the highest income group. And exposure to having a strict ban in the home went up in the lowest and the highest income group. So these results now are by education stratification, comparing home smoking policies after versus before the ban, and participants having a strict ban in the home went up in both people with a high school education or lower and some college education or higher, and people with a higher education were more likely to have a ban in the home after the law was passed. So to conclude, it seems that Wisconsin Act 12 increased reported no smoking policies in households across Wisconsin. It also seemed to decrease reported exposure to secondhand smoke at home, at work, and outside the home. There wasn't too much of a difference in changing the behaviors of individual smokers, and it's important to understand that those behaviors are more difficult to change. And if these results are maintained, smoke-free legislation could be key to reducing the incidence of tobacco-related illnesses and could improve health outcomes. And these are the people I'd like to acknowledge. And if you'd like to learn more about the Survey of the Health of Wisconsin or gain access to some of our data, you could visit our website at show.wisc.edu or speak to me after the talk. Thanks.
Thank you. If I could have all the presenters come up, and we can do some questions since we have lots of time. And I would like to take the moderator's privilege and start asking my own questions first. So for the cell phone study, it seemed to me that the target demographics that you were looking for were found in the cell phone group. So my question to you is, would it not perhaps be a better strategy to oversample the cell phone group and reduce the proportion of landline users? I know it's more expensive, but it's going to give you the data that you need.
I'll take that one. We come close, but where we really are off the mark there is that we would miss out on older adults.
But right now you have a proportion of like 3-to-1 landline to cell phone.
Yeah.
And maybe you should flip that is what I'm saying.
If we could afford to do so, we might, but then we would need to be overreaching to get seniors and older adults.
Are there any more questions for the cell phone study? Yes.
Repeat the question. She asked how we're comparing trends over time with the cell phone and without. In the analyses that we release to the community, we report top-line numbers with all of the different samples included. So it's only for events like this where we really dig in and look at how we got the respondents that we did and really think about how we're going to sample going forward, which is one of the reasons why we made the change we did in methodology from sampling cell phone only households to cell phone mostly households, which is where most of the national surveys that are sampling are going, so we are following sort of the state of the art. And everyone is still working this out. It's kind of a work in progress everywhere. So, yes. That's an excellent question. What was our response rate in for the landline and for the cell phone? They were typical of what everyone else was seeing. I don't remember the cell phone response rate. The response rate for the landline is in the mid-30s, like most similar surveys. So.
Okay, now we move on to salad bars in schools. I have a question about that. Is there data to indicate what percentage of kids who attend schools that have salad bars purchase food from there?
I don't believe that that's in the latest CINDA, I'm trying to recall, but in a previous iteration of the CINDA survey, there had been, they did look at that question, and I can't remember the data off the top of my head, but there is actually a report purely on the salad bar demographics out of CINDA 2, if I recall correctly. Mm-hmm. Well, so if you're familiar with the school meal regulations, excuse me, they're under revision currently. There's an interim regulation from USDA which will ask schools to provide more fruits and vegetables, and they're specifying the variety of fruits and vegetables that are provided for kids. So schools will be under increased pressure to provide more fruits and vegetables. And school salad bars are an easy way for them to do that. So a budget for a school food service program is a zero-sum proposition. So they'll need to perhaps adjust their purchases in other area in order to provide more fruits and vegetables. There's also ways that schools can accommodate through judicious choice of commodity foods through the USDA Foods Program. For example, there's canned beans, low-salt canned beans in that program. There's frozen corn, frozen peas, which are great salad bar items, which are low cost to the schools.
Okay.
I'm out of my own questions. Do we have any questions on the delayed immunization survey?
So the question is about whether there's conversations in Kaiser to delay or to limit benefits for people who delay or...
Or more broadly, to provide incentives for people to...
Oh, to provide, okay.
Sure.
I'm not familiar with the dental part of that question. In Kaiser, Colorado, there isn't dental care. We get our dental through a different organization. There are incentives within Kaiser and within most of the managed care sites participating in BSD to get immunization. So, for example, in Kaiser, most plans, preventative services are free or very low cost. So there are incentives to get your child vaccinated.
I am not aware of any conversations in Kaiser to limit benefits for children who do not get their vaccinations or whose parents choose not to get their vaccinations. Thank you for the question. Anything else? Yeah.
The way that you are measuring under vaccination, if I'm understanding it correctly, because it was a lot of material, did you make your PowerPoint available, by the way?
Oh, I'm not sure.
I think they're probably all available through the e-learning thing if you sign up for that, but I'm not sure because it's a late breaking.
But anyway, so what you are doing is adding up the total number of days of delay for all vaccines and coming up with one combined measure, right?
Right.
So it seems like buried within that are a couple of assumptions that, let's say it's a 200-day delay, that a 200-day delay at 2 months, 2 to 4 months of age or 6 months of age would be roughly equivalent to the same number of days delay if it occurred later on in life, like after the first year. And it also seems like it assumes that that across vaccines that it would be roughly equivalent in terms of physiology.
Mm-hmm.
Did you try to think about how you might be able to deal with some of the non-equivalents in that measure?
That's a great question. And so just to repeat the questions have to do with when you're looking at days delayed, there's probably differences depending on what year of life you're looking at and the importance of it, and then also the relative importance of the different vaccines and the different doses. So let me do actually the second question first. Actually, one thing that someone on our team is working on, another biostatistician, is looking at this concept of could we expand even further on the metric and somehow take into account weighting for either the prevalence of diseases in a geographic area, the morbidity and mortality associated with some of the vaccine-preventable diseases, the efficacy or effectiveness of various doses. So for example, it's probably more important that you get your first DTaP than your fourth booster dose. So trying to look at some of those things and seeing if you could create a weighted metric. I think that's really interesting and important work. It's also a little difficult because putting relative importance to each of the vaccines and each of the doses is a little difficult. So we are thinking about that. Now, as for the first question, in terms of average days under vaccinated, you're right. Like if we say that someone is 80 days has 80 average days under vaccinated in the first 2 years of life, that doesn't really tell you when it was. You'd have to actually be, in the data to see that. But I would say that if you're going to use one of these metrics and that is a concern of yours, you can limit the time period. Like you can calculate days under vaccinated just till 6 months or just till 8 months or just to a year. That's definitely a kind of a limitation when we're looking at 2 years.
And it does seem like that in your successive outcome studies, you would have to peel off the kids who were delayed for pertussis-containing vaccines sort of versus all others. Right,
and so in those studies, those were conducted differently. Those were case control studies, and they went back and did medical record review to confirm that, to look at whether children, they matched cases controls, they went and did a medical review all children to look at whether they had the vaccine or not and whether the parent chose to do so or not. So that was a heavy medical review study. Thank you for your questions.
Any more questions on that presentation? Okay, and questions on the final presentation about the smoking law in Wisconsin? It's been a long morning already. All right, well, seeing none, I suppose we are adjourned early. Thank you all for coming. Stop by the booth, and if anyone needs tickets to the section social, I have some right here.